a knit cap, prosecutors say Simpson wore the night of the double murders. Although O.J. may have heard his case when he suddenly blurted out, Hey, careful with that. That's my lucky stabbing hat. Norm MacDonald. Number 11. In music news, number one on the college charts this week was Better Than Ezra. And at number two, Ezra. Norm MacDonald. Number 12. According to a controversial new biography, Elizabeth Taylor likes her lovemaking loud, rough, and frequent. Coincidentally, that is also how she likes to eat. Norm MacDonald. 13. Well, it's official. Michael Jordan is leaving baseball to return to basketball. It is unclear whether the media will now refer to him by his old basketball nickname, Air Jordan, or his more recent baseball nickname, Senior Crappy. Norm MacDonald. Number 14. In Walnut Creek, California, anyone who turns in his gun can now get free therapy. Anyone who does not turn in his gun can get free anything. Norm MacDonald. Number 15. Earlier this week, Marlon Brando met with Jewish leaders to apologize for comments he made on Larry King Live, among them that, quote, Hollywood is run by Jews, unquote. The Jewish leaders accepted the actor's apology and announced that Brando is now free to work again. Norm MacDonald. Number 16. At Virginia Commonwealth University, a professor is being sued after revelations that he spanked one of his students. It was the student's parents who became suspicious when they asked, what kind of marks are you getting? And she replied, big red ones on my ass. Norm MacDonald. Number 17. Yippee! Jerry Rubin is dead! Oh, I'm sorry. That should read, Yippee Jerry Rubin is dead. My apologies. Norm MacDonald. Number 18. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan reports that her husband has been relaxing at their ranch, riding horses and chopping wood. Sadly, eyewitnesses report that he was actually riding wood and chopping horses. Norm MacDonald. Number 19. It was revealed this week that mass murderer Richard Speck, while serving a lifetime sentence in prison, was videotaped with hormone-induced breasts, snorting cocaine, and having sex with a man. The film was apparently made with prison video equipment and a $300,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. Norm MacDonald. Number 20. Dr. James Watts, a neurosurgeon who performed the first frontal lobotomy, died this week in Washington. If you recall, a lobotomy involves drilling holes in the skull and then inserting and rotating a knife to destroy brain cells. What a genius. He'll be missed. Norm MacDonald. Number 21. Officials in Disney World have ordered their ride, the Extra Terror Estriel, to be shut down so they can make it even scarier. When the attraction reopens in 2 weeks, it will be exactly the same, but missing one bolt. Norm MacDonald. Number 22. Last week, on his latest trial for assisted suicide, Dr. Jack Kevorkian startled a Michigan courtroom when he stood up and shouted, "This is a lynching!" Everyone turned to look, and sure enough, he'd just lynched some old guy. Norm MacDonald. 23. On Wednesday, world chess champion Garry Kasparov tied Deep Blue, the IBM supercomputer that can examine 200 million positions per second, in the fourth game of their six-game series. Earlier in the week, Kasparov admitted he made a catastrophic blunder in Game 2 when he failed to force a draw by moving rook to e8, opting instead for a Caro Kann defense that soon transposed into a Pribble defense, which, after Deep Blue moved bishop to e7, gave it the advantage with its ninth position. With all due respect to Mr. Kasparov, what the hell were you thinking? Norm MacDonald. Number 24. A French man who calls himself the Human Snake was arrested this week after climbing up the side of a Manhattan high-rise. Yep, he climbed right up the side of a high-rise. Just like a snake. Norm MacDonald. Number 25. In North Dakota this week, a hunter narrowly escaped death when a pocket knife in his breast pocket deflected a bullet shot by another hunter. Man, you know we have too many weapons in this country when people are getting shot in the knife. Norm MacDonald. Chapter 31. The Fat Man with the Artificial Hair. Adam Egott slams on the brake and the car screeches to a stop in front of the Ski Inn. The parking lot is empty. At the top of a hill, we can see the mansion that is home to the fat man with the artificial hair. "Behold the Salton Sea, boys," the barkeep says, as he wipes a perfectly clean glass behind the bar. 20 years ago, it seemed like a surefire bet. But look around and know that nothing is certain. We looked out the window. Out at the uncertainty of it all. The town looks torn to hell, with the young meth heads stumbling around and giggling and scratching at itches that never go away, and the old men, rum-drunk, driving golf carts aimlessly through the rubble. No one goes near the beach. The sand, beside the Salton Sea, cannot be seen. This is because it is covered a foot deep in the broken skeletons of dead fish. And the stench is everywhere. "What happened here, old man?" I asked. "What killed everything?" "Salt." "Listen, old man, you're not making any sense, and you're making Adam Egott nervous. I want to go home, Norm. I want to go to the Comedy Store and ask to get my job back." "You see, boys, salt corrodes. It eats everything. Steel, rock, the dreams of men. I've seen it with my own eyes, boys. Salt can even kill a sea and eat the fish that live there." "But salt is what makes a sea." "Too much salt," mutters the old man and walks away. "Too much salt." And so Adam Egott and I walk, ankle deep in fish skeletons and sludge, up to the giant unfinished house on the hill, the house that contains my last hope in this cold, cold world. As I get close to the entrance, I see the biggest red Cadillac I've ever seen. It's a beautiful thing how big it is. And I understand how a real fat guy would want a big car like this. And it's the brightest red. But even this expensive, beautiful car is not immune to the salt. There is disintegration along the edges, where the salt has eaten away at the steel. I hear a noise, and there stands a boy who must be about 10 years old, holding a big gun. "What are you here for?" the boy asks, and I carefully recite the line Gabe gave me. "I am a desperate man, here to ask a favor." The boy leads us through the house and into a large room. The room is magnificent. Red marble floors, oversized chairs with gold inlay on the mahogany arms, immaculately clean. There are 3 well-dressed goons, the type who like to punch you in the stomach, and they stand behind us. In front of us is a large table where the fat man with the artificial hair is eating a meal. "Sit down, boys," he invites us to the table with his meaty paw. "Well, we don't want to disturb your meal. Would you care to join me? It's tilapia. I caught it only an hour ago." "But the bartender said that the fish were all dead. He said the salt ate them." "He spoke the truth. The salt ate every type of fish but one." The fat man with the artificial hair picks up a piece of his fish with a fork. "Only the tilapia survived. It takes much more than salt to kill a creature like the tilapia fish." And the fat man with the artificial hair takes a salt shaker, twists off its top, and pours half of it in his mouth. I can hear the salt crunching like glass between his teeth. I look around and notice there aren't any drinks on the table. "How much you boys need?" "He needs nothing, ever," I say, motioning to Adam Egget. I need $1 million, and I only need it for a week. The reason is, no, he interrupts without looking up. It's none of my business. Carlos, get the man his $1 million. These are the terms. The first month is free. After that, I charge 1% per week. Hold on, I say, that's $10,000 a week. That's pretty thick juice. Yeah, says Adam Egget as he stands up. That's horse shit. No deal, fat man. One of the goons quickly punches Adam Egget in the stomach, and he falls to the floor. Did he just call me fat? The fat man with the artificial hair asks, and the hurt in his voice surprises me. Adam Egget is doing his best to apologize, but he can't get a sentence out proper because he's still recovering from the massive blows. Sorry if I was out of line. Oh! Ah! Ah! With that crack about, oh! Ah! That sort of thing. It'd be sad to watch if it wasn't so funny. So let me understand. You think that $10,000 a week is too much to pay me if you lose the million. Yes, Adam Egget gasps from the floor. Yes, I think that is too much. Let me ask you something, boys. Are you planning to lose this $1 million I am loaning you? Is this what I am hearing from you? Oh, no, sir, I say. No, not at all. I have a plan, sir, and it's not to lose. It's to win and to pay you back quickly, taking advantage of your generous first-month-free deal. Carlos enters the room with a duffel bag, and I can tell by the way he walks that that duffel bag is heavy, $1 million heavy. Sign this paper, says the fat man with the artificial hair. This catches me off guard, and I laugh. Here we are with two goons standing by Adam Egget, another with a red duffel bag full of money, and the fat man with the artificial hair is acting like we're in a legitimate bank doing legitimate business. But I don't care. I'll sign anything. My name is as worthless as a bent penny, and if it helps me to scribble it on a piece of paper, no problem. But when I look down at the document on the table, I understand. It's a life insurance policy he wants me to sign. It will, upon my passing, pay $2 million to my beneficiary. And across the table from me, smiling like a crocodile with salt-cake teeth and handing me a pen, sits my beneficiary. It came to me in a dream, he says. I smile right back at him and sign the paper.
A piece of coal will never become a diamond, no matter how long you wait. That's the truth. But forget the truth. Coal is famous for becoming diamond. Mr. McDonald had a moment in the mid-90s when he was a diamond, and I watched him on TV and thought he shone brilliantly and had facets. But it was a lie, and we were all fooled. Mr. McDonald was and is a sad, misshapen, crumbling chunk of the blackest coal. Before I can walk once again in the sunshine of New York as an important author, before I am seen as the diamond I always have been, I must finish this damnable memoir. I must find Mr. McDonald's essence, and to that end, I must become him. I have begun donning his preposterous wardrobe. Now when I look in the mirror, instead of seeing a fashionable New York gentleman, I see a costumed clown, a slovenly mess, each piece of clothing an advertisement for McDonald's past success. Twice when I have ventured out in the street with the costume, I have nearly been mistaken for him. I can see how people see me and search their memories for my name but are unable to bring it to their lips. A few times people have thought they went to school with me. I have been poring through all the tapes he's given me, dozens of TV shows and movies I never realized he'd done, and each one is worse than the last. I'm captivated by the boxes of videotapes of Mr. McDonald doing stand-up, stretching from 30 years ago to the present. The tapes are fascinating only in that they each contain the exact same stand-up material, word for word. And finally, I've been reviewing all the tape recordings of me interviewing him. On them, he often flares up with anger and shouts things like, I'm giving you gold, Keen, gold, I tell you. And I think, you have given me straw and a Rumpelstiltskinian task. A few weeks ago, Mr. McDonald called me from Las Vegas and told me a story of meeting Andy Griffith at an airport, and he insisted that the encounter be transcribed word for word. I have never done such a thing. To let a celebrity's words unvarnished touch the page goes against every instinct I have as a ghostwriter. So after I hung up, I phoned Julie. She's the boss. To my surprise, Julie agreed wholeheartedly with Mr. McDonald, telling me that what she is looking for is authenticity. It must have been my imagination, but when she spoke, I swore I could hear the oaf grunting like a swine in the background. I do not consider myself a cruel man, but since it is out of my hands, I can't help but smile, knowing the reader will have to endure a small taste of what I have been force-fed a steady diet of for nearly a year now. A story by Norm MacDonald, word for word.
Chapter 32, Word for Word. It's true what they say, never meet your heroes. It turns out they're all a bunch of fucking assholes. They're probably the reason you turned into such a fucking asshole, because they were your heroes and you spent all your time trying to be like them. Let me tell you a story from my life so you can understand what I mean. It was a day like any other, except Ben Matlock was standing really close to me. But besides that, it was a day like any other. Yeah, right. Like every day Ben Matlock is standing really close to me. That's a laugh. I was at the airport because I had to take a plane, because I had to go do stand-up in Portland, Oregon. I'm really good at stand-up. Then I look over into the bookstore, and who do I see? You're never gonna believe it. It was Ben Matlock. I shit you not. And he was standing there, reading one of those big books. You know the kind? Usually you can't even understand their stupid titles, and when you try to read them, you get one word in and get really sleepy. And it's so stupid to try anyway, because if the stupid book is any good, they'll make a TV movie out of it, and then you can watch that instead. They'll probably get an actor, like that guy from that one episode of Mannix, to be in it. What the fuck is that guy's stupid name anyway? That guy that was in that one episode of Mannix. Now, you must remember this happened a long time ago, back when Ben Matlock was still alive. Literally, nobody but me had spotted Ben Matlock, and I didn't want to blow his cover, but I sure did want to meet him. Who knows? Maybe we could become friends, and I would introduce him to my buddies by saying, "Hey, you know who this guy is? This is old Ben Matlock himself. He never lost a case. Hey, Snake, you should hire this guy next time you get in any trouble. He'll keep you out of the joint. Just stop making your stupid face and show some respect and get the man some cheese." The problem was, I hadn't even met Ben Matlock yet, and I knew at any time old Ben might hear his plane was ready to go and then I'd be fucked. I shit you not. I needed a plan, but fast. I looked at the table with some books on it. I searched for a title, like How to Come Up with a Plan, but Fast, or The Art of Fast Planning, but no, nothing, just a bunch of fucking shit. I grabbed an Archie comic from the rack and began to read it as I snuck up beside Ben Matlock. It was that one where Jughead gets a job at Pop's Chocolate Shop, and the gang can't figure out why he took it, because Jughead is such a useless bum who's always mooching off his friends. But it turns out that Jughead just took the job because he knew they'd let him wear one of those oversized chef's hats, and he could use the hat to steal hamburgers. That Jughead is a dirty, thieving son of a bitch, but he sure does make me laugh. When I was right beside Matlock, I threw the Archie comic away and grabbed the biggest, thickest book I could find and turned to a random page. Then I loudly said, "What the fuck? I certainly didn't see that shit coming." Ben Matlock turned his back to me. I kept talking, but way louder this time. "I don't know about you, fella, but I love books. and the bigger and heavier, the better. Matlock turned and looked right at me. I almost fucking shit my pants. I shit you not. He's like, I must say it's refreshing to see a younger man who appreciates literature. And so then I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, I love all that shit. I'm a comedian by trade, but mostly I like reading big, long books with titles you can't understand. And, of course, I like TV shows, especially ones about lawyers. And, hey, I just realized who you are. Why, you're my favorite TV lawyer of all. And that's when my mouth got real dry and I had no words, and I realized I'd been tricked. It wasn't Ben Matlock at all. It was just some old man. He didn't even look like Ben Matlock. I just spent over 2 minutes talking to some old man. Who the fuck would ever do that? There's not a day goes by that I don't think about that stupid old man and how much I hate his fucking guts. Chapter 33, Way Out of Line, The Making of Dirty Work. Many times young people will approach me to ask me how to make it in show business, and I always offer the same foolproof advice. Just remember three little words. Meet Adam Sandler. The rest pretty much takes care of itself. Sandler had vouched for me to be on SNL. In the summer break, he put me in his first film, Billy Madison, and then he told Robert Simons, who produced Billy Madison, you should give Normie a movie. And that was that. I went from being a low-paid road comic to starring in my own film due to one guy's help. I've never thanked Adam for doing all that for me or told him how lost I'd be without his generosity. And I never will, either. That's because I'm a self-made man. So I had an offer to do a movie, but no ideas. That's when Frank came to the rescue. One night, while we were working late on update, Frank came up with a concept. The movie would be about a guy who was good at getting revenge. So he and his buddy open a revenge-for-hire business. Later in the film, it turns out his buddy is actually his brother. Spoiler alert! We brought on a third writer, Fred Wolf, who worked with us at SNL and had plenty of motion picture experience. Robert Simons told us that the next task was to select a director. This turned out to be a problem. I wanted Frank to direct Dirty Work. He knew the script better than anybody and had studied film at NYU. But the biggest reason I wanted Frank was that I already knew him. If we didn't hire Frank, I would have to meet some new guy and learn his name and pretend laugh at all his jokes and ask him if his parents were still alive and listen as the guy told me that they both died last week, days apart from each other. Then I would have to buy the guy an expensive watch. I really hated meeting new guys. So I got Robert Simons on the phone. Robert, I think we need to talk about a director. I got just the guy, said Robert. Is it Frank? No, it's Bob Saget. What, are you nuts? Let me ask you this, Norm. What comes to mind when you think of Bob Saget? I don't know. A bunch of shit, I guess. Norm, he's more than Full House and America's Funniest Home Videos. Did you know that he's already directed a film and won a Student Academy Award? What? That's right. It was a film school documentary called Through Adam's Eyes. It was about his 7-year-old nephew who underwent facial reconstruction surgery. I watched it. Very moving stuff. Well, thanks for the wonderful news, Robert. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have to run. What's the hurry, Norm? I have to buy Bob Saget an expensive watch. When Frank, Fred, and I were writing Dirty Work, we had actors in mind for each part. I don't have the imagination necessary to create a man out of nothing, so we decided to go the opposite route. We wrote the movie by choosing our dream cast first and then writing characters based on them. We wanted Don Rickles. We got him. We wanted Chevy. We got him. We wanted Jack Warden. We got him. We wanted Sandler. We got him. We wanted Chris Farley. We got him. We wanted Bill Murray. We were still waiting to hear back. Our only problem was that we had written the script as a buddy comedy, and we hadn't yet cast the buddy. When it came to comedy films, Frank and Fred were experts. They told me that since I was a skinny guy, my buddy should be a fat guy. I got real mad and decided I needed to remind them who was boss. That's a bunch of horse shit. What about Laurel and Hardy? They were both skinny, and they were really funny. Turns out I was wrong on that one. So I continued, as my face grew red with anger. And what about Abbott and Costello? Or Ma and Pa Kettle? Or Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise? Or Jackie Gleason and Art Carney? Or Belushi and Aykroyd? It seemed that every example I came up with not only hurt my argument, but bolstered theirs. But I saw a way out. Well, it takes a big man to admit he's wrong, and I admit I'm wrong. So I'm a big man. A big, big man. What about you two? Are you wrong? Frank answered, "No, Norm. Fred and I are right." "Yeah, that's what I thought, which makes you both very small men. And I feel sorry for you." We looked at every fat guy in Hollywood, but nobody seemed to work for the role, and we were beginning to panic. Then one night, 3 days before we were supposed to fly to Toronto, I happened to turn the TV on, and for the first time ever, I saw an episode of Mad TV. An actor named Artie Lang was talking straight to camera, not in character, and he was hilarious. What impressed me the most was that he wasn't relying on fat man tricks. He had a melancholy about him that reminded me of Belushi. I knew instantly that he was the guy for the part, so I phoned Robert Simons and told him about Artie. But it was a big part, and he informed me that an audition was necessary. So Artie met with Bob Saget and me. Artie's reading was perfect, and I knew we had our man. When he left, Saget and I phoned Robert Simons, and Robert said, "If he works for you guys, let's do it." But an hour later, Robert Simons called back. "Bad news. The guy's got a big coke problem." "So what?" I said. I had 6 grams of morphine rushing through me. "Listen, Robert, you know as well as anybody that it's drugs that makes a guy funny," I said. "Of course, Norm. But this guy got caught. He went to jail. It's public record. That's why he's back in New Jersey, out of the business." "God damn," I said. "Look, we can still make it work," Robert said. "But you have to be sure he stays clean the entire time he's in Canada. Can you promise me that?" "No," I said. It was such fun to be back in Canada, my true home strong and free. I was born in the Great White North, and I remain to this day a Canadian citizen, and will till the day I die. And I'll tell you why. Canada is the country that shaped me, that taught me right from wrong, that turned me from a boy to a man. Also, that American citizenship test is way, way too hard. Trust me, I've tried it quite a few times. But no more. You know the old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me thrice, shame on Adam Egot, pretending to be me and failing even worse. Fool me 4 times. Shame on the guy behind the desk at the Immigration and Naturalization Office, who said he would see what he could do for 100 clams, and then said he couldn't do a damn thing, but kept the 100 clams anyway. Fool me 5 times. Shame on the filthy homeless bum who could rattle off all the presidents in less than a minute, but then the moment I gave him $20 to do the test in my stead, took off running down the street with a whoop and a holler. Fool me 6 times, shame on me again, for threatening to burn down the federal building in New York City if I wasn't given citizenship immediately. There would be no 7th time. Nobody ever accused this old country boy of being stupid. But it turned out to be all for the best anyway. I finally come to my senses. I was born a Canadian, and I'll die a Canadian. And I will forever be proud to count myself a citizen of Canada. The 14th greatest country in the world. A month after our first phone call, Bob Saget and I walked down the longest street in the world, Yonge Street, in Toronto. People recognized Saget everywhere we went and would say, "Hey, you're Bob Saget." And Saget would turn to them and say, "Thank you," as if it was a compliment. It was hot and crowded and dirty on the longest street in the world. Young Street runs near 120 miles from north to south. You can visit the Hockey Hall of Fame there, or have a donut and a cup of coffee at Tim Hortons, and the runaway kids are on every corner, selling love to the Americans who go up there to make movies cheap. And in the summer of 97, the kids that nobody misses were missing, and there was a bad man on the loose, and it wasn't Saget, and it wasn't me. And it wasn't Adam Egede either. I don't care what anybody says. Adam Egede had done things, sure, but they weren't bad things. They were the things that young men do when they need money. Breaking and entering, stealing cars, selling those pills you're supposed to take when your ankle hurts real bad, smuggling cigarettes across the border, and jerking off punks under the Queensboro Bridge for $15 a man. Those kind of things. But nobody ever got hurt meeting Adam Egede. Still, Saget and I decided we would keep Adam Egede out of sight so the Ontario Provincial Police wouldn't be sniffing around the movie set. If they saw a way to blame this whole Young Street unpleasantness on a young American boy, that would be just dandy with the Canadian John Law. Just dandy. Chapter 34, Mr. Warmth. For the most part, the cast of Dirty Work was a dream, with the exception of one man. He didn't disappoint me as an actor. He was brilliant in the film. No, this man disappointed me in a deeper way. He disappointed me as a human being. I'm speaking about Don Rickles. Now, I was a huge fan of Mr. Rickles and was thrilled at the prospect of finally meeting him. I guess I knew just about every word from Toy Story, where he played Mr. Potato Head. I also loved him in Toy Story 2, where he reprised his role as Mr. Potato Head. And I would be negligent if I didn't mention how great he was in Toy Story 3, where he played Mr. Potato Head. But I also knew him from The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson, where he was a frequent guest. When he visited Johnny, I must say in all candor, I never found him funny. Johnny, a true gentleman, always kindly introduced Don as Mr. Warmth, and then Don would come out, and let's just say, not live up to this nickname. Don would immediately begin on poor Johnny, being boorish, and, yes, I'll say it, in some cases downright insulting. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm no fan of phony balonies. I like a man who is direct. I like a man who is honest and plain-spoken. But there is a big difference between frankness and insults designed to hurt people. And somewhere along the way, I think, Don lost sight of that difference. I approached him the first day in the makeup trailer and introduced myself as I sat down. I just want to tell you, Mr. Rickles, that I feel so honored that you would agree to be in the film, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart, sir. He shook my hand. That's very nice, Norm. By the way, I spoke to the home. Your room will be ready Tuesday. The trailer erupted in laughter, and I felt rage deep in my soul. I caught sight of myself in the mirror and saw that my face was beet red. I wasn't on any waiting list for any type of home, as Mr. Rickles was clearly suggesting. But I swallowed my anger. I was determined to find the real man through my own kindness and love. Mr. Rickles, I would be honored if I could take you out to one of Toronto's finest restaurants and buy you dinner tonight. I have a better idea, Norm. Why don't you go to a shed in the desert with a rake and go brrr? This awful, classless burping noise got the cheap laugh I'm sure Mr. Rickles is used to, but not from me. I could feel myself begin to shake with rage as everyone laughed at me, but I held it together. Well, maybe a rain check then, sir. If there's anything you need while you're here, just let me know. I could see I'd finally gotten through to him because he gave me a wide smile and put his arm around me. Actually, Norm, there is one thing you could do for me, if it's not too much trouble, and I'd be forever grateful. I was so happy to finally reach the real Don Rickles, and I said, anything, sir. What would you like? Well, Norm, I'd like you to get a monkey and an organ grinder and run around the room going, I lost my sock, I lost my sock. And Mr. Rickles then pranced around the makeup trailer doing a grotesque pantomime of me searching for a missing sock. Now the laughter rose to a volume I'd never heard, but I knew it was not genuine laughter. It was the type of laughter that springs from nervousness and embarrassment. I felt burning tears run down my cheeks, and I fled the makeup trailer. I took a nice long walk, trying to compose myself. I think it was the comment about losing my sock and then running around telling everyone that hurt the most. Some things are just beyond the pale. I thought of Johnny Carson and how he was able to take this sort of abuse from Don, time after time, while the whole nation watched. It was a testament to Carson's great security as a performer. Any other host would have had him ejected from the studio. When I felt whole again, I returned to the makeup trailer and decided to give Mr. Rickles a few words he'd probably never heard, but certainly needed to. I stormed in without knocking. Now listen, Mr. Rickles, we are going to be working together in this film, and I do not want any hard feelings, so I have a few things to say. I think that much of what you do is frankly insulting. It is completely uncalled for. That's great, Norm. Now, why don't you take a train to Wyoming and milk a Clydesdale? This was again followed by a long period of embarrassed laughter from everyone present. It stung like a wasp, but I kept my dignity and with a quavering voice told him once again how happy I was to have him on the project. I don't regret telling Don Rickles what so many were afraid to. I guess, looking back, my only hope is that one day Don will remember my words, reflect on his life, and make some really meaningful changes in the way he chooses to treat people, especially strangers who pay good money to see him in nightclubs and theaters. Chapter 35, The Shoot. The shooting of the film was a blast, but getting to work with such experienced and talented movie actors proved to be a double-edged sword. Now, I understand that all swords have two edges, so let me save some time by taking that back and just saying that getting to work with such experienced and talented movie stars was a sword. By watching these actors work, I could study them and steal many of their acting tricks. But I always felt they had no respect for me as the star of the film. Often I would catch them gathered together as I performed a scene, and I could not ignore their withering glances. They looked at me the way real vampires look at Count Chocula. But that was not to be the worst of it. Not by a long shot. I had brought Adam Egott to Toronto to assist me on the film. Once again, I must emphasize with all the vigor at my command that Adam Egott never once assisted me. On the 10th night in Toronto, Bob Saget woke me in the middle of the night. There was a problem with one of the cameras from the previous day's shoot, and we would have to redo a scene before the sun came up. So I stumbled out of bed and phoned Adam Egott, but there was no answer. I knocked on his hotel room door. No answer. So I took a cab to the set. We reshot the scene, then I rushed back to get 2 hours of shut-eye. When I woke up, there was Adam Egott with a muffin and a coffee. How'd you sleep, boss? Not well. Where the hell were you last night? I was in my room. I phoned you 100 times. You didn't pick up. Oh, yeah, that phone is broke, he said, blushing. I knocked on your door for 10 minutes. Yeah, I think that door might be broke, too. Where the hell is my paper? What paper? The Toronto Star you bring me every day with my muffin and coffee? Oh, the guy at the front desk said they went out of business. That's absurd. Go get me my Toronto Star, Adam Egott. He returned 10 minutes later, with a newspaper with the front page torn off. What's going on? The guy said you could have this one for free, since it has no front page. Tell me the truth, Adam Egott. A young man's body was found in a ravine last night. He was a teenage runaway, just like the rest. I thought you might suspect me. Did you have anything to do with this? No, of course not, boss. Well, where were you last night, then? I couldn't sleep, so I did what I always do when I have insomnia. I went out and found a ravine to relax in. A ravine? Yeah, a ravine. Was it the ravine where the teenager's body was discovered? Oh, no. Jeez, I can see why you'd be suspicious if it was the same ravine. No, this kid was found two ravines over. Well, who the hell goes to a ravine to relax? Not me anymore, that's for sure. This whole thing's giving me the willies. Well, I told everybody that you weren't in your room last night. The police will be all over the set, and if anybody tells the cops that... I'm scared, Norm. Should I buy a gun? A gun? No. That would be the worst thing you could do. If the police talk to you, you have to tell them you couldn't sleep last night, so you went for a walk down Young Street. I paused for a moment. You wouldn't kill a string of runaway teenagers, would you? Norm, you know I couldn't harm a fly. Right. But what about a teenager? Never. Okay, buddy, let's get to work. That morning scene was one where Artie and I got in a huge bar fight. It was very physical and involved a lot of stuntmen. I didn't want the stuntmen to roll after they landed, because I always thought that looked fake in movies. I wanted them to stop abruptly when they hit the cement, which was much more painful for the stuntmen. Frank, Fred, Saget, and I were going through the choreography of the thing when I saw two police officers in the corner, speaking with Adam Egott. Hold on, guys, I said. My stupid friend needs my help. By the time I'd made it to Adam Egott, he was already cuffed and being led away. Hold on, hold on. There must be some mistake. We're just going to the station and having a little talk, that's all, said one of the cops. Well, that settled it. There was not much I could do but get back to work and forget about this. Chris Farley showed up, and we all sat down to have some breakfast. 20 minutes later, I got a phone call. Adam Egott had made a full confession to the murder of 14 teenagers. I phoned Robert Simons at once. Robert, you're not going to like what I'm going to tell you. I told him the whole affair. Norm, I'm going to be straight with you because I've been in this business a long time. If the star of a movie has a personal assistant who, during the production of that movie, butchers over a dozen teenagers, that's going to hurt at the box office. Well, he had nothing to do with it, Robert. A production assistant suddenly ran from the other side of the room and whispered in my ear. Oh, well, this is not good news, Robert. I've just been told the media has dubbed this affair the Dirty Work Murders. Now, that doesn't seem fair at all. We might have to pull the plug on this, Norm. And he hung up. At the police station, I muscled my way through the crush of reporters to get inside. When I saw Adam Egott, he was sitting in a small interrogation room with a big smile on his face and two pies on the table before him. One of them was nearly finished. Hey, Adam Egott, how are you holding up? Fine. We can leave soon. I just wanted to finish this second pie. The first was cherry, but I saved my favorite for last. Strawberry rhubarb. He whispered the last part as if it was a secret. Why do you think we can leave after you finish eating? Because that's the deal. The policeman asked me what I wanted, and I said I wanted to go home. And he asked if I wanted anything else, and I said two fresh pies. And he said that if I signed a paper, that I could get my pies and then go home. That paper you signed, Adam Egott, that was a confession that said you killed 14 people. But Norm, you know I couldn't murder a fly. I wasn't sure what to do. We'll get you the best court-appointed attorney in the whole city. Back on location, the arrest of Adam Egott had cast gloom across the set. I hadn't told anyone about it, but word gets out in this media-soaked age. Every day, the actors would have to dodge the press on their way to work, and the questions invariably had nothing to do with the film. The media, as usual, was interested in one thing and one thing only. I decided to hold a press conference, so these buzzards would finally leave us alone. "Ladies and gentlemen of the press," I said, "I appreciate that your city has endured a nightmare of vicious murders, that began 2 days after we started pre-production on our movie, Dirty Work, an MGM film that will make its theatrical debut next summer. The motion picture has very good buzz about it, and I would hate if this unpleasantness somehow hurt that. Of course, a film is not as important as a young person's precious life. I understand that my personal assistant, Adam Egott, has been dragged into this unfortunate affair by signing a full confession to all of the killings. But, trust me, Adam Egott couldn't murder a fly. He just has a sweet tooth, that's all. And since when did loving a fresh-baked pie become a crime? Also, I would implore you not to continue to refer to these killings as the Dirty Work murders. I know that's a lot to ask, so, in order to help, I have come up with a list of names for these murders that I honestly feel are much better. I will be handing the list out to you after I finish speaking, along with a Dairy Queen gift certificate for $100. I will now take questions, and I hope some of them will be about the film. None of them were. I finished the presser and returned to the set. We were shooting a great scene that day. It had been Fred Wolf's idea. In the scene, Artie and I break into a mansion and hide rotting fish inside, thinking it will be unbearable for the people who live there. While we are busy hiding dead fish, the owners come home, and Artie and I hide in the next room. But the owner is there to complete a multi-million-dollar drug deal, which goes horribly wrong, leading to a shootout, a chainsaw murder, and finally a grenade that kills everybody. But all that activity is heard off-screen, while the camera stays on Artie and me, frozen, holding our ridiculous fish, our expressions never changing. I wanted the shot to be completely static, for Artie and me to be totally still, and I wanted the scene to last for 1 minute. We initially had trouble filming the scene because after cameras were trained on our faces, Saget started saying things like, "Okay, now you hear gunshots," and, "Uh-oh, a guy has a machine gun," and, "Now a guy has just pulled out a chainsaw," and on it went. It was very distracting. But the idea was that Artie and I would have one blank expression of terror for the whole scene, and it was tough to hold that while Saget was blabbing on and on. I finally told Bob to just say action, and a minute later say cut. The take went well, and we were happy, but it didn't last for long. Wouldn't you know it, moments after we finished the scene, a production assistant came up and silently handed me that day's Toronto Star. Dirty Work killer admits to 60 more crimes in the Toronto area. It was beginning to look like Adam Egott was more trouble than he was worth. After the day's shooting, I went back to visit him. He was weeping softly and shoveling pie into his mouth. "Adam Egott," I said, "I'll get you pie if you want pie. You must stop signing things." "I'm afraid, Norm. Do they have the chair up here in Canada?" "No, they don't have the death penalty." The news put a big smile on his face, and he ate his pie faster. "But we're going to get you off on this, Adam Egott. Don't worry." And so we toiled on the movie. But what should have been a joyous time was instead full of grief, as funny scenes were trumped by coroner's inquests, and Dirty Work, which had been conceived as a buddy film, became the nickname of the most notorious crime in Canadian history. I couldn't wait for the whole thing to be over, so I could get back to the United States and as far from Adam Egott as possible. Even though I knew he was innocent, I was tired of the whole affair, and when it came down to it, with Adam Egott's small brain, life on the inside would be the same for him as life on the outside. I just hoped none of this would hurt the movie or my career. Then one day, something wonderful happened. Jack Warden approached me as I ate lunch. "Did you read the paper today?" he asked, beaming. "No, Jack. Why?" I asked. "I'll tell you why, kid. A runaway teenager was found dead this morning in a ravine." "No way. That's the greatest thing I've ever heard." "Isn't it?" said Jack. "That clears your boy, Adam Egott." "It sure does. And it means they won't shut down the film." Saget came running in, deliriously happy, clutching a newspaper. They found a murdered teenage boy in a ravine this morning. Isn't it fantastic? Farley entered, dancing a jig, and bellowed, Guess what, everybody? A monster is still on the loose, and no teenager in Toronto is safe. Yahoo! It seemed everybody was getting the good news at the same time. And that day, the mood of the movie set changed for good. It's funny how something as small as the news of a teenager being slaughtered and tossed in a ravine can be enough to lift the spirits of an entire set full of important Hollywood people. The next day, Adam Egert was released from prison, and the press stopped using the term the dirty work murders and instead called them the very bad guy murders, which was one of my original suggestions. We returned to work on the film, and from that point on, it was the best summer I ever had. Footnote. In 2006, a drifter from Baffin Island named Albert H. Codfish was arrested for the very bad guy murders. He made a full confession. In 2008, the City Council of Toronto passed a law commanding that every ravine in the metro area be manned by police officers night and day. Since then, in the city of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, no one has killed anyone. It turned out that my worries about Bob Saget were unfounded. He did a great job directing the film, and there isn't a performance in the whole movie that isn't funny. When the film finally opened, the critics were split. Some hated it, while others hated its guts. But it didn't matter to the public. On its opening weekend, Dirty Work grossed $250 million. Chapter 36, Torn Apart. The duffel bag full of cash is in the trunk of the idling Challenger, and we sit by the Salton Sea ready to go. But where can we go? Vegas is out of the question. As soon as word leaks that I took a powder after losing $1 million at 4 different casinos, nobody on the strip will take my action. I could always turn to online betting, but trying to collect a massive win from an offshore account is a hopeless endeavor. I'd have to get lucky twice, once to win and another to collect. So that leaves only one option, Atlantic City. The problem is that Atlantic City doesn't take sports bets, so I'll have to win at the tables. The other problem with Atlantic City is that it's 3,000 miles away and our time is precious. The fat man with the artificial hair has the meter running. We fill the Challenger with gasoline at a run-down station off Highway 111 and get the hell out of this apocalyptic wasteland. We're driving east down Highway 8. The white Challenger is moving me toward my fate at the rate of 70 miles every hour. This will be the last of it. Win or lose, my 20-year gambling spree will be over. It has all been such a waste. It's not the wasted money that gets me, because money comes and goes. It's the time. And with that realization, I feel a profound sadness as I remember all the wagers, all the adrenaline, the bad bets, the lucky wins, and all of it for nothing. I know in this moment that my fever has broken and that I will never again feel joy or despair at the roll of a die or the turn of a card. I will feel nothing. Now I'm free. And the profound sadness I'd felt only a moment before melts away. And the cessation of pain produces joy. So I begin to laugh, which makes Adam Egert laugh, which makes me laugh harder, and him laugh harder yet, and now the Challenger is filled with hysteria. I have not been this happy since I was a little boy. The gamble is gone. The laughter goes on for a long time, and only our exhaustion ends it. When long laughter ends, something serious is always said. Adam Egert says it. Norm, I was thinking. We could always turn around and go back and give the fat man with the artificial hair his money back. You could cut some kind of deal with the Vegas casinos. Gabe said they'd do that. You could work. You could go on the road and you could pay off your debts little by little. I would go with you. I'll help you get out of this. He is right, of course. That is the smart play. The chance that I can make the $1 million sitting in the duffel bag into the $3 million I need to pay my debts and buy my ranch is remote. I consider what Adam Egget says, and a few times I nearly ask him to make a U-turn back to sanity. Then, somewhere on the road, somewhere in the darkness, I remember something. Atlantic City is where all of this began. Atlantic City is the reason Adam Egget must stay with me and not go home to where he wants to be. Of course this must end in Atlantic City. How can I lose? The gamble is back. A moment passes, and I can suddenly see Atlantic City ahead in all its shabby splendor. Snow begins to fall, just as it fell nearly 20 years ago. I look at Adam Egget, and Adam Egget looks back at me for a long time. This turns out to be a huge mistake, as the white Challenger finds a patch of ice and slips from the highway and is torn apart by tree after tree. Adam Egget is thrown clear, but I am not. I see total black, and then bright white light. Chapter 37, The Bright White Light. It is as white as salt. I am walking on white sand. I can feel it between my toes. But when I look down, I have no toes, or legs, or body either. So instead, I have to imagine what I looked like when I had those things. And when I finally see myself, I am wearing jeans and a plaid shirt, and I am young. I am not walking as much as being led by my imaginary feet, and I am approaching the source of the whiteness, which is as brilliant as diamonds and as soft as wool, and in the whiteness I see figures. "Stay with me," I hear Adam Amiget's voice from far away. My Aunt Barbara is there with Uncle Bert. He was the beloved town doctor who delivered babies and accepted chickens as payment. He was a saint. They are standing beside a Christmas tree, under which is the Louisville Slugger I received when I was 6 years old. I see my first dog, Tracker, and drool drips off his big red tongue. And there is Anna, whom I last saw when she was 18, and I loved her, and we said we would be together forever. They beckon me toward them with outstretched hands, and I approach. "Stay with me!" But then a thought occurs to me, one that had never occurred to me in my whole life, that there is still unfinished work back in the real world. The fact of the matter is that I hadn't really done any work whatsoever back in the real world, and now I am starting to regret it. What if one of these jokers in this white world all of a sudden asked me what I accomplished when I was alive, and I have to tell him nothing. I just never got around to it. That wouldn't sound too good. I could just make up stuff, the way I did in the real world, but I'm scared that here they would know I was lying. So I decide I can't stay. I'll go back, do some sort of grand work, maybe back at SNL, and then return to these people and brag about my fine and finished work forevermore, to all who will listen. And so I bid the dear departed adieu, and turn on my imaginary heel to leave. "Stay with me!" My Uncle Bert smiles tenderly. "Wouldn't you like to go with me to the deepest lake you can imagine, where we can spend the day trying to fool a trout with a bit of flying feather? Or perhaps we'll take Tracker and try to rustle up a grouse. How does that sound, boy?" "Stay with me." Well, it sounds pretty good, all right. But that's not what clinches it. What clinches it is Anna. I look at her and notice she is still 18 and that I'm 18, too. I remember our promise so many years ago that we would be together for all of time and our love would never die. But Anna was too gentle for the world and its cruel ways, and she jumped from a bridge on her 18th birthday. And so I decide right there that I will stay. I will stay here and hold Anna's hand, and we will walk together into the white, white light. As I approach my loved ones, I say, "Hey, where's Uncle Basil anyway, and Aunt Ida? Why, they were the most pious people I ever knew." They all fell silent, except for Tracker, who starts in with a low growl. And I remember, with a start, that Tracker had to be put down after he killed that infant girl. And hadn't there been talk around town that Uncle Bert, the beloved country doctor, may have spent years injecting patients